One. Welcome back, everyone. Rabbi Ken Spiro, welcome back.
Always good to be back. We took a break there. We're back in action. Lots to talk about.
Yeah, lots of traveling, lots of things happening. So is there anything on the ground that we need an update on before we jump into this particular podcast? Anything we need to know?
Yeah, well, in terms of, we've been all the episodes you've recorded of late have all been taking place during what is now like turning into Israel's longest war. Or you could argue the War of Independence was off and on for over a year, but this is in terms of continuous combat, this has turned into something we've never experienced. And we've kind of reached a critical phase in the fighting where the northern part of the Gaza Strip was basically the Israel told the Palestinian population to move south, and then Israel moved into the south. And now the last and trickiest part is taking what's called Rafah, which is on the border with the Egyptian Sinai. And we're all these a lot of these people are living in tents, so it's very, very tricky given that the Hamas has embedded itself within the civilian population, and Israel, to finish the job, must go to every single part of Gaza, including Rafah. And we see that a lot of the goodwill and support that Israel had at the beginning of the operation, which was triggered by the slaughter of 1,200 is unprovoked slaughter of Hamas on October 7th, has kind of worn off, and now we're just looking at the casualty figures as if that's the measure of who's right and who's wrong in a war. Whichever side loses more people is the wrong side. Is the right side is certainly not the way we view war at all, but that's the way it's being viewed now. So Israel's stuck within a really difficult place, and the U.S. already starting to equivocate. Biden And you have to be super careful, not that civilian. Israel is super careful. The problem with this particular conflict is because Egypt is not opening up the Sinai to allow refugees in. This is a population that's trapped in a very small area.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting that that always gets left out of the picture, right? Like there are, Israel's surrounded by 22 Arab countries, all of whom could open their doors to refugees and let all of those people in the same way Poland and Hungary and all of the surrounding area of Ukraine let hundreds of thousands of people into their borders while the war was raging. And none of those Arab countries, especially Egypt, which actually borders Gaza, that they have a, they not only did they not let them in, they built an even bigger wall between
Exactly.
the two places. So I think that's a fascinating point of information that people ignore largely is the fact that all of those surrounding countries are not letting any Gazas into their borders while this war is going on. So
Right. And they're
yeah.
pushing for ceasefire. And of course, remember that Israel knows, as Bibi said, that anything short of the complete destruction of Hamas is will be viewed as a victory by Hamas and disastrous for Israel. They'll come back and fight another day and build more tunnels and shoot more missiles. And the whole, it's going to change. It'll negatively impact Israel's, the view of Israel and the entire Arab Middle East. It'll be a disaster. And if the world, by the way, ultimately the responsibility of all this is the world's fault. I know it sounds weird, but obviously they're not directly killing Jews. But if the world would say, as their mantra, there was a ceasefire on October 7th, and Hamas started by viciously targeting civilians, breaking that ceasefire, and then embedding themselves in the civilian population, using them as human shields. So all casualties in this conflict, be they Israeli or Palestinian, are the fault of Hamas. Trust me, if the world would say that over and over again, this would end very quickly. I'm telling you, Yehia Sinwar is literally, I'm sure he's betting heavily on the international pressure and especially the US caving as being what's going to save him. And so this is the trickiest phase of this conflict. And because we're going so carefully through our soldiers, we're losing a lot more people than we would normally, than any army would have lost, precisely because we are going house to house and trying to minimize casualties. But the destruction now, because every house and every school and every hospital is being used as a firing position, the destruction of in Gaza is unbelievable. It's just a byproduct of the fighting. So it's very hard to limit it to one area. So we will see, but this is definitely reaching, in many ways, the most difficult part of the conflict. And then, of course, what's going on in Lebanon, what's going to happen there, whether that will be the next theater of war, whether pressure will be put on Hezbollah to pull back. And if that war happens, it's going to get really nasty because Hezbollah is a much more significant force with a much bigger arsenal of much more sophisticated weapons. The only advantage Israel has in that war is that it's in a country and the civilian population can get out of the way which gives Israel a much more free hand to wreak havoc and devastation on Hezbollah forces in southern Lebanon. Hopefully we won't get to that. We'll see.
Yeah, God willing.
We will see.
That'll be a whole other piece of the puzzle. So the last part of that is, you know, as we saw, thankfully, in the news the other day, where two of the hostages were rescued, you know, as they went into Rafah. So I wanted to dig in a little bit, because really one of the crux pieces of this entire thing, and as you said, the willful blindness of the international community to the fact that over 250 innocent civilians were taken hostage, women, children, foreign nationals, into Gaza, into the tunnels, and has largely been ignored by the international community as a point that is a crucial matter in this war. So I would really love to understand a little bit more historically, and also even halachically, meaning what is the Jewish viewpoint on the redemption of the captives, as we know, which is an incredibly important mitzvah in Jewish law, and how do we relate to the idea of hostages? So maybe we can get a couple of terms defined, and then we can look a little bit more at the history of hostages, both Israeli and Jewish, and what the response has been. But maybe let's start with a definition, because as we were sort of talking about this episode, you made a very, I think, important distinction, because one of the things I was curious about when we talk about hostages is, you know, I was saying, does Israel ever take hostages? Or has Israel ever taken hostages? And you said they have prisoners, not hostages. So can we make a definition between what is the difference between a prisoner and a hostage? And why is that important?
In terms of warfare, you know, prisoners are soldiers who are captured or surrender. So those are prisoners of war on either side. In all of Israel's wars, you know, the Arabs, surrounding Arab armies, have taken Israeli soldiers as prisoners. We've taken Arabs as prisoners. There's been situations where, especially in the 73 war, where some of these prisoners were treated horribly. Some were killed or tortured. Jewish law does not allow for the torturing of people. You can't. So the Israel, which is a modern democratic state, which generally follows principles that are really established through Judaism, the value of life and how you treat people in warfare in general, is really an idea that originates in Judaism. I think we mentioned previously the notion of non-combatants and how you treat them and things like that is really comes from a Jewish perspective and has become the basis of, you know, international legislation based on that. But just in terms of abusing prisoners aside, in war, prisoners are always taken. They're soldiers. They're taken as a byproduct of the fighting. And certainly the Jewish perspective on that is that at the end of when a ceasefire is reached or negotiations are reached for exchange of prisoners, you just each side exchanges its prisoners. There's no specific price tag put on, even if we take many more prisoners than the Arab armies take Israeli soldiers. At the end of the war, you don't do like, okay, you gave us 20, you only have 20 more soldiers, we're going to keep the rest as prisoners. No, Israel has, and this is the way armies generally behave, is all prisoners are released at the end of a war. These are the combatants. These are the people who know the risk when they go into battle, and therefore they're exchanged, you know, when the war is over, versus hostages, who are people who are deliberately, usually non-combatants, you know, who are deliberately taken by sometimes a military force, in the case of, like, you know, Shalit in 2006, who was stolen out of a tank, you know, across border, like a mini version of what Hamas did in October 7th of 2023. But generally speaking, hostages are taken in situations in you have bank robbers who hold hostages in a bank because they're trapped by the police. But you have the more common situation is terrorists holding people as hostage, either as a byproduct of the fighting because they're trapped, like they're trapped by an army in a building or a police force in a building, so they're holding people as hostages, or they deliberately, in the case of what we see with Israel and our enemies, is they're deliberately taken, civilians or soldiers. It's not part of a war. It's just a deliberate operation. And generally the goal is to, in the case of Israel's enemies and the terrorist organizations we face, Hezbollah or Hamas, whether the hostages be dead or alive, by the way, because both Hezbollah and Hamas have taken plenty of bodies of people, because even we value our dead. You know, people want the soldiers back and the civilians back to bury them properly. But they're taken specifically not for financial gain. It's never been Hamas asked, you pay us $1 billion, but it's to gain the release of Arab prisoners who are not soldiers. Usually they're generally terrorists who Israel have taken prisoner, whether they're people who are Israeli Arabs who were guilty of terrorist attacks, or people living in the Judean Samaria, you know, the West Bank or Gaza. So it's generally done for that. So that's the situation.
So really what we're saying is, for instance, like a prisoner or a prisoner of war is taken as a part of the theater of war. It's one of the tactics they use, is if you capture the enemy's combatants, you put them somewhere so they can't keep fighting you until the war's over, and then they all get released. A hostage, and I think a lot of the time we're somehow trying to do some mental gymnastics of separating out, like every single heist or terrorist movie in Hollywood, you know how bad the villain is based on how many hostages they take, right? Like this is, you know, there, it's one thing to like, you know, to rob or steal or to do something, you know, illegal, but taking hostages really makes you the villain. Right. And I think we've
also
seen
who
that.
You take. Right. So, who you take hostage and how you treat them. Yeah.
Right. Right. And we've seen, you know, all these movies where people's daughters are taken for money. There was an entire era in South America where hostage taking was a business. You took people's family members, you ransomed them for large sums of money. And that was basically one of the parts of the economy. And, you know, you had to travel with armed guards if you had any kind of money or means. So generally, taking hostages has been an explicit sign that you're a bad person. And I think that's the difference, is what you're saying. Prisoners of war is part of war. Hostage taking is criminal and illegal and absolutely unacceptable in any theater, even war.
Exactly. Okay. And it can be done for, you know, it's a business.
It's a leverage.
It's very old.
Right.
It's a business very old. Pirates, you know, kidnapping people. Like you said, you have it more recently, you have it going on, especially in places like South Central, like Mexico is a big issue. But in Jewish history is full of, you know, different people being taken hostage, ransom.
Right.
And also there's another part of this, which is, you know, as a byproduct of more ancient warfare where prisoners were taken, or a civilian population is taken for slaves, is ransoming those people out of slavery. It's called pidyon shvuyim in Jewish law. It's considered a very big mitzvah to save a Jew from being kept as a hostage in a situation like that, where they're amongst the non-Jews and not only going to be abused physically, but spiritually unable to obviously live properly as Jews, because slave owners are not going to be kosher catering and giving you Shabbat off and things like that. So it could be quite a brutal situation. Today, with the situation we have with hostages, is we have terrorist forces that are taking hostages for, again, as leverage to get other people released, but it's part of the kind of their tactics of warfare. It's part of their strategy in a, you know, to just target. First of all, it terrorizes a population, puts people in fear, but it also gives them a certain leverage, especially in asymmetrical warfare where it's not two equal armies fighting each other. It gives them the ability to impact or leverage, not just to release prisoners, but in the case you see now going on, push for things like a ceasefire, because they're in no position to negotiate a ceasefire. The losing side of a war usually has one choice, you know, surrender or die. So, but we got people hostages. Well, like, so just as the bank robbers in the bank, you storm the bank, we'll kill the hostages.
Yes.
Hamas, which is kind of trapped by overwhelming military superiority of Israel, is saying, you know, we're going to try and get two things out of this. We're going to get an end to the conflict and save our skin. And we're also going to get thousands of prisoners released, which not only is going to be fueling, giving us lots of terrorists for future fights we can have with the Jewish people, but then if it's viewed as a victory, look, we got something serious out of it. We got more valuable than money. We got our terrorists freed, like Yehiya Sinwar, who's the head of Hamas in Gaza. was freed in the Shalit exchange in 2011.
Right. You know, it, for a modern example in North America, for instance, it's like a bunch of gang members take a bunch of people hostage. And they say, we're only going to release these hostages if you release all of our gang members that are in prison right now, so we can replenish our ranks and keep being gang members. Like, it's really like a wild leverage. And in many ways, like, is weaponizing Judaism's and Israelis' attachment to the sanctity of life. Like, we are not going to leave our people. We're not going to say, fine, just kill them all. We're not going to negotiate with you. We're not going to take the bait. We're just not doing that. And like you said, even if they kill the hostages, we're still going to go in there because we believe we need to bring the bodies home. So it is, in a way, also our enemies knowing us so well that this is the one place where we're always going to be vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you look at wars and, you know, fighting, like in crusades, whatever battles you look at in human history, there's an idea that you had high value targets in terms of who you could grab. So like Richard the Lionhearted, who was actually even the King of England, was never in England. He spent most of his time fighting. But at one point, he's held hostage in Germany, but he's royalty. So the difference being with Western liberal democracies in general, and Israel specifically, because the value of life that very much colors how we deal with things like ransoming hostages back and getting civilians out of harm's way and things like that, overwhelmingly comes from the impact of biblical morality on Western civilization. But in the ancient world, you know, the average, even soldier in warfare was often slaughtered on the battlefield. Wounded people for sure were just killed. You see these movies at the end, the winning side is walking through and spearing all the guys wiggling on the ground who are half dead, finishing them off. You didn't give them first aid or anything like that at the battlefield. And a lot of the prisoners are just slaughtered. It's a very common thing. But if you got a high value captive, a lord or a king, someone like that, there's a person, again, who, even this is in the context of a war, that you would ransom them back. You wouldn't kill them. At first, it wasn't so cool to kill kings anyway. Kings don't like killing other kings because it knows that when they're captured, they'll be killed too. But these were the people. So now it's spilled over into the fact that, you know, since we have an idea that, you know, all human life is valuable, that's the Western liberal democratic idea, which comes from the Jewish point of view, that everyone is made B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. So we value all life, and we go out of our way. It's not like, to hell with them. They're just peasants. You can kill all of them. In the ancient world, it's very common. You know, throw your own cannon fodder. Just send people to die. We don't care about them. But now Israel, which is the source of these values, the modern Jewish state, which is based on largely, which is inhabited by Jews who have a value system that comes from Torah, even if they're not religious, we all go nuts over the value of human life. It's an idea that we brought into the world. And again, it's a huge commandment in Judaism, a huge like positive thing to do, to ransom back captives, regardless of what situation they're taken captive in.
Right.
Whether it's through warfare, through conquest, through people deliberately targeting Jews and taking them as prisoner because that's their business, is capturing people and ransoming them. Mm-hmm. So it makes us very susceptible. It's almost our weakness. You know, our weaknesses are humanity's greatest strengths. They really are. But we're just such nice people.
One of the reasons, look, we often know that something becomes a central part of Jewish law because that thing is likely to happen. And so meaning like, why make a law around something that we never have to deal with? So, you know, the very fact that the redemption of captives is a really central law to Judaism. It's something that we hold as actually one of the great, you know, most important mitzvahs in the hierarchy of mitzvot is because it happens a lot. Israelis and Jews are captured and held hostage, often not for the purpose of information, right? The other difference we would say between a prisoner of war and a hostage is a prisoner of war as a combatant might have intelligence information. Maybe you can get information from them on what their troops are doing. Whereas a hostage is somebody that holds no value whatsoever in terms of your means other than to leverage for ransom, because they don't have intelligence, they don't have information. You know, like a four-year-old kid and their mother is not going to be able to tell anybody about the military plans of the Israeli government. So it's a really different. So I think when we talk about Jewish law, it implements this idea of redemption of captives as being so important, because it happens a lot. So can we talk a little bit about the history of hostages, people being taken hostage, and what that looks like?
Right. You say it happens a lot. So Ellie, one thing people need to understand is that Jewish law holistically covers everything. It's not just religious law. I mean, a lot of people listening are aware of that. Mm-hmm. It's the legal system given by the creator of the universe, which covers the physical and the metaphysical. So there's nothing outside the purview of Jewish law from this profound spiritual side of, you know, animal sacrifice and prayer and ritual impurity and purity, to laws of going to the bathroom and setting up a military camp. And so everything is in there. Mm-hmm. And also one of the other things about halacha that's so interesting, well, it's based on principles, because technology and geopolitical realities change, halacha is very adaptable and it's gone through a process. The principles are eternal. How you apply them changes, which goes from anything from, you know, modern, you know, technology related to electricity and the laws of Sabbath and clocks that turn themselves off on and off automatically, to changing geopolitical realities of the world. If you look in the Bible stories, there are a couple of stories in the Bible of battles where Jews are taken captive. The classic one is Abraham. You know, the earliest story you see is Lot, Abraham's nephew, is taken captive in this battle in the book of Genesis, the four kings against the five kings. And in that story and all the stories you see in Tanakh, which is the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible, be they in the book of Joshua or later in the book of Samuel, any of those situations, there's no idea of redeeming the captives. You go to war to release them. Like Abraham goes to war, he gathers his little band of soldiers and he rescues Lot.
Right. So they generally don't negotiate with terrorists. They don't negotiate with somebody who takes a hostage. The taking of a hostage is the beginning of a war.
Right. And these people are just taken hostages, primarily, again, in the ancient world, human beings, after land, were the second most valuable commodity, to be either taken as, you know, forced to be taken as, you know, wives or raping and or slavery, basically for slaves.
Right.
So there's not going to be any offer to, like, we'll sell them back to you. Generally speaking, we want them because they're, like, more valuable than pretty much anything else we have. So that attitude is the initial attitude you see. And this is what the Israeli army is doing now, by the way. Number one, you know, there's two missions of this war, is to remove Hamas as a threat, as it has been since it's taken over Gaza, going back to, you know, 2006, 2007, when after the election and seizing control in 2007, also to release the hostages. And that's one of Israel's demands. You know, no ceasefire until you release the hostages. But even if Hamas were to agree to release the hostages, Israel would not allow Hamas to remain in power. But we've seen that, especially in later Jewish history, when we end up in diaspora and we are, Jews are scattered around the world, traveling around the world and living amongst non-Jews, then you have, when it becomes much more prevalent throughout history, for Jews to be, I mean, it's not just Jews. We're not the only targets of this. The Mediterranean, which was not only treacherous at certain times of year to sail across, but there was a lot of pirates who would go and raid shipping and not just to get, you know, the booty of the gold and the silver, whatever else is being transported, but actually take people as hostages. Some very famous stories in the Bible of rabbis being taken hostage and being ransomed. One of the most famous stories is not that old by Jewish standards. It's the 13th century. It's Rabbi Meir, the Maharami Rutenberg, who was from, you know, one of the earliest Jewish communities in Western Europe. You know, one of the earliest is in Germany on the Rhine. He is from the city of Mainz, and in the 13th century, because of increasing taxation on the part of the German authority. I'm just simplifying the story. A lot of Jews are trying to flee, and he is captured and he is held prisoner. I mean, he's not captured by a band of lost people. He's captured by a nobleman. And he's kept in prison. Just going to hold you ransom, you Jews. I mean, Jews serve as a great source of revenue in medieval Europe, not only collecting taxes for non-Jews because we're literate and numerate. We can read and we're good at numbers, but taxing Jews as part of their, you know, the contractual agreement whereby Jews are allowed to live in certain places, you have to pay a certain amount of money for different things, is a great source of income. But one of the quicker ways in medieval Europe, if you needed money fast, was expel them and confiscate all their stuff. Why tax them slowly when you can clean them out quickly, which is what happens in places like Spain in 1492. but also, you know, take Jews as ransom, hold them as prisoners. And again, they're high value targets. We Jews don't have, you don't have kings running around in Jewish kings, but you do have rabbis. Rabbis are some of the highest value targets because we Jews value wisdom and are willing to pay a lot for such people. So the Maharan.
And again, high value targets, knowing that part of Jewish law and Jewish culture is we'll do anything we can to get them back.
Right. So the Maharan is the price put on his head to ransom him back was exorbitant, and he refused. He gave orders that you will not pay this price. So he spent 7 years in prison. He refused to have himself ransomed, and he died in prison. Afterwards, a wealthy Jew ransomed his body back for a much less, just for burial. Right. But this massive discussion in Jewish sources, primarily amongst the Rishonim, who are the rabbis who are basically from the 11th to the end of the 15th centuries, including people like the Ramban and Rashi and all these people. Everything in Jewish law is basically a machloket, this discussion. There's a range of opinions on this topic. So it's not like all rabbis say, but what is overwhelmingly universally agreed upon is that you have to pay fair market value for a person. It's a huge commandment, a mitzvah, pidyon shvuyim. To ransom a Jew back is a huge mitzvah, but it can't be at the expense of bankrupting the Jewish community, and it can't be exorbitant over price for value. And there's a whole, by the way, Judaism has whole discussions on value of life.
And I think, I think, you know, just to throw in, it's constantly the argument that I've seen in relation to this topic is the personal versus the universal. What's the personal responsibility? We always say the personal responsibility is get that person back. But the responsibility to the community is, number one, to not be bankrupt. And number two, to not encourage more people to be captured, meaning now this becomes a business. They know we'll pay, so we're going to take more people. And so we're always caught in Jewish law around the clashing, the clash between redeeming this person and getting them back, which is ultimately huge, and the protection of the community. And that's where we're always going to be at a loggerhead. And there's no good answer because this is never a good situation.
Exactly. And it's a great, what you point is perfectly correct. It's that balancing what the community can afford. But the bigger issue is encouraging. It's called negative reinforcement. You know, and like I said, Me'ikar Adin, as we say, the original pure narrative earlier back in Jewish history, is no such thing as ransoming captives. You fight to get them back and that's it. But once it becomes the ability of halakha to adapt to a situation is when we're no longer in a situation to necessarily fight, especially when we're living in diaspora, we don't have armies, we're not empowered to do so. So you're balancing on that fine line between saving a Jewish life, getting that Jewish life out of captivity amongst non-Jews where they could be in physical danger and spiritual danger, versus paying too much money, which will only set a standard which will greatly increase the desire of our people who hate us, or just people doing it for purely business reasons who are not ideologically motivated, to kidnap more Jews, which will just make the situation worse. It'll be a vicious cycle. Right. The community will be stuck in an endless cycle of having to pay greater and greater sums to release people, and there's no end to this at all. So,
I think
European powers, by the way, they look about the Marines and the Barbary Coast Pirates in the 18th, America's first exploits. The 18th century, when the Europeans weren't really doing anything, this is Jefferson. They sent in the Marines to take the Barbary Coast, the North African pirates, out, because there America was in a position militarily to use its fledgling navy in the early 19th century. The beginning of America as a country to do that. But Israel, we were not in that position. So we had to deal with the practical reality of what can we pay. And also, it's interesting, one other interesting example, we talk about the history. So the Maharan of Rutenberg is probably the most famous story of one high value individual rabbinic target who refused to be ransomed. But when you had a situation where it's not terrorists doing it for business, but let's say when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70, the Great Revolt was from 66 to 70 CE. When victorious armies in ancient warfare, besides raping and pillaging, there would be a lot of looting of valuable stuff, obviously any treasures, gold, silver, things like that, holy objects, statues, whatever you could take you thought was valuable. But taking prisoners was a huge business because these prisoners would be people who you could, of course, rape, kill. In the case of Rome, you could have them kill each other in the Colosseum or feed them to animals for entertainment. But again, their biggest value was slaves, which again, after, you know, gold and silver aside, after land was your second most valuable commodity, nobility was often how many slaves you owned was one of the greatest signs of your wealth.
Right.
And with the destruction of what was a very costly revolt for the Romans, tens of thousands of Jews were taken as slaves and brought back to Rome and sold on the slave markets. It was, you know, the big business to sell human beings as slaves. It's one of the most ubiquitous business practices in human history is slavery. And we know from Jewish sources, Roman historians, Jews talking about, that the Jewish community of Rome, which was in place before the destruction of the year 70, was very involved financially in redeeming Jewish captives who, according to historical sources, there were so many Jews dumped on the slave markets that a Jewish slave was going for less than a horse, because the third most valuable thing you had would be your livestock, horses and cattle. So you ended up with tens of thousands of people who ended up greatly boosting eventually the Jewish community of Italy, because they were redeemed and then freed, which could explain, by the way, Ellie, why genetically Ashkenazi Jews, the original Ashkenazi community is in Italy, why Ashkenazi Jews are between 40 to 70% genetically Italian. Because then all these Jews who were redeemed probably ended up
meaning they were all slaves in Rome, in Italy. They were redeemed and became part of the population and then moved north to the Rhine
Some Jewish redeemed slave would marry some Italian, some Roman woman who obviously would convert to Judaism. And because they're like, we like the Italian food. We get along well. They're not killing us.
Right.
We got along with Mediterranean people. So it's an interesting little side point genetically, but there's another example of how you have massive taking of prisoners and huge redemption. The largest redemption of Jewish prisoners in the ancient world are events like that, where you have a huge number of people. It also happened at the expulsion from Spain, where a lot of Jews set sail for the Eastern Mediterranean, the Ottoman Turkish Empire, and many of them were taken as slaves. And it could be more lucrative for many of the pirates or people involved in this to actually directly approach the Jewish community, knowing that they would probably pay more for Jews than these Jews would fetch being sold as slaves. Because we are very sensitive to the value of life and redeeming captives. So there you could see it could be greatly incentivizing the further taking of even more captives and the raising of the price of those captives.
So let's come up to modern times a little bit, you know, because now we understand that historically this is something that is embedded in the Jewish experience. We've had to develop ways of dealing with this, whether we have an army or no army. And if we come into the modern for Judaism, meaning, you know, not medieval, but the taking of captives, Jewish captives, Israeli captives, when necessarily the point isn't to sell them into slavery. However, the point is another type of leverage. You know, I think what we're seeing as modern leverage is, for instance, although, God forbid, we suspect that some of these hostages now have been put into a slavery position, which we're hoping isn't true, but we're suspecting maybe. But for those who were taken, for instance, for the leverage being PR, the leverage being, you know, telling the world that, you know, the Palestinians are victims and therefore they're taking hostages to call attention to their plight. You know, what is the leverage of the modern day taking of Jewish and Israeli hostages, which has been unfortunately rampant, and how do we understand that? So what are some examples of modern experiences like that, and how does Israel generally deal with that?
So that you see one of the great Palestinian contribution to civilization being that their identity was only created in 1964 by the KGB through Nicolae Ceaușescu and the Romanian secret police, which is something people should look into. It is a very modern identity, but I'm being sarcastic now. One of the things they really perfected is airplane hijacking,
right?
Often of Israeli flights, but also of mixed flights of Israelis and Jews and non-Jews, the Sabena airline flight. This was done starting, you have this, and really it took off in the 70s. It was very, very big. is hijacked.
Which I think people don't remember that this was a regular thing. You know, the whole idea of peace, you know, peace in the Middle East being a big thing started with there being this consistent experience of Palestinians and the PLO hijacking planes. So give us a bit of a rundown.
Hijacking planes in Israel, which are often like the Sabina hijacking, which was Bibi Netanyahu was in Sarat Matkal. He was in the Israeli commando unit that released the hijackers, that killed the hijackers and released the captives on that plane. That was in Israel. That's an interesting case. The most famous of all is what's called Operation Thunderbolt, which was in on the when an Air France plane was hijacked by a combined PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, along with some like Marxist German terrorists, and taken to Uganda, the Entebbe raid, as it was called. Over 100 hijackers were taken, and
hostages. Over 100 hostages.
Hostages right. were taken by the hijackers. And there was like a standoff with Idi Amin really not doing very, very much. And this is when, again, Israeli commandos led by Bibi Netanyahu's older brother, Yoni, went in. This all took place on July 4th, 1976, which is the bicentennial of the American Revolutionary War. I remember this. I remember this very clearly because I was in high school at the time. And it was like, I think 106 hostages were taken. And it was a daring raid to, and they were demanding, again, the demands made are always A, to get press coverage for the, you know, and demand the release of Palestinian prisoners and often other terrorists also thrown in. Sometimes it's a kind of international exchange thing. We want these countries to release Germans to release these Bader Meinhof terrorists. Right. And we want Israel to release these Palestinian people who were arrested for various terrorist offenses. And Israel, in that case, pursued what is the halachic ideal standard, which is, you know, you can stall for time by negotiating, which is a classic tactic in hostage negotiation, mm-hmm. is stall for time to try and wear the kidnappers or the terrorists down and then hopefully be able to release them, which is what happens when they actually storm the airport and 102 of the 106 hostages are freed. The terrorists are killed. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the only casualty on the side of the Israeli commandos was Yoni Netanyahu, Bibi's older brother, who was killed and died later of his wounds. And I think 5 Israeli commandos were killed. But that's like the classic, amazing, that really boosted Israel's view. It was like, what an incredible thing to fly into Uganda.
Right.
And to fool the Ugandan security that was around the airport. The whole thing was
there's definitely books about it. There's movies about it. And I think the entire world was delighted and shocked when they saw the audacity of what the Israeli army did in that operation, where literally they went into another country and rescued 102 hostages from a really volatile, vicious terrorist organization. So it was just an unbelievable victory. Any other examples? Because I think Entebbe is usually the gold standard that we all referred to. And I think, as we'll get to, we're kind of hoping maybe that will happen this time, like that there's still over 100 hostages in Gaza. And we're sort of hoping maybe an Entebbe will happen. But I'm not sure that's going to be the case. But are there, before we get to that, are there any other examples of Israelis or Jews being held hostage that we should be aware of in our history?
Well, the problem is that we've seen more recently, and the classic one was the Shalit exchange in 2006, when we had the second, there's a lot going on in 2006. We had the second Lebanon war, but we also had, at the same time, in Gaza, we had a cross-border incursion by Hamas. They were digging tunnels back then. They actually did a mini version of what they did on October 7th, where they killed a bunch of Israeli soldiers. And in a tank crew, they got one soldier, Shalit, who was taken prisoner and dragged back into Gaza and kept there for 5 years. They had him as a prisoner. I believe it's 5 years because in that case, Israel was not in a position to go in and rescue him. So you already see, and it's not the first example. There have been what's happened in the last few decades is that Israel has been unable to release hostages for whatever reason, and release the hostages, and has gotten to negotiating. And the problem is these negotiations have kind of violated the Torah principle, like the Talmud in Tractate Gittin, basically the statement they make when dealing with payment. It says, don't pay exorbitant amount of price for your hostages because it's going to encourage more and you're setting a standard. Once you start negotiating at a certain price, it's going to be hard to change that price. So in the case of Shalit, when they finally negotiated for his release, I think it was like 1,027 security prisoners or terrorists Israel released for one Israeli soldier, which in my mind was crazy. But that kind of set the standard for how the negotiations have gone since. Oops. I don't hear you anymore.
Sorry, even before that, am I remembering correctly, was the Munich massacre, well, Munich, was that also a hostage situation or did they just kill them outright?
Well, Munich was 1972 Olympics. Now in Munich, yes, they broke into the Olympic compound. Israeli athletes were killed on the spot. And then I think it's, again, I could be wrong. I didn't have to refresh my memory on this. In the end, this is not where Israel was not allowed to. Israel offered to come in and do the hostage release. Israel had already, by the 70s, you know, we've been training our commando squads to do what the ideal thing is to do, which is to, you know, stall for time and attempt and kill the terrorists and release the hostages.
Right. In this case, I think their demands were also Palestinian prisoners, they said.
Right, like, and their demands was also because they were trapped in Germany, they wanted to escape. We're going to take us now. We're going to go, it's this helicopter, we're going to fly out of the country, and you're going to, right. We'd have certain demands also. And in that case, in 1972, the German counter-terrorists squad at the airport, when they were loading the hostages and the terrorists on helicopters, completely blew it. It was a totally botched rescue operation. In the end, the terrorists just threw hand grenades into the helicopters where the hostages were kept. And I think it was 11, I'm not sure, all the Israeli hostages were killed in that sense. But there was that, there was Israel not being allowed to be involved in the rescue operation. The Germans didn't feel they wanted foreign counter-terrorist squads on their soil. But it was a horrible example of it going really, really south, really wrong, really badly. So, but those are cases where it never got to the point of exchanging anyone for anything. These were had the terrorists. The situation, unfortunately, changed, especially with the narrative, because now it's not terrorists who are separate in an airport somewhere or, you know, in a building somewhere. This is, you know, an entire part of a piece of real estate, which is one giant terrorist-controlled training base, which is what Gaza is, where we bring the captives in and we have them in our territory, underground, in a tunnel, which just means we don't even know where they are. But the ability to operate and go in, as you can see what's going on in October 7th and onward, it's much more difficult because just as Hamas has embedded itself within its civilian population, it's using these terrorists, it's using the hostages as human shields. And we're not even sure where they are. And what's, you know, are they booby-trapped? And we can see what happened. We had even a case of, more recently, his daring operation into Rafah, which is that last area which Israel has to move into near the Egyptian border, where they rescued two Israeli hostages who were, you know, famed family. It was an amazing raid, but it was very complicated. Whereas about a month ago, a little longer, three hostages who had escaped were killed by Israeli soldiers because they didn't recognize them. They thought maybe it was a trap, which unfortunately the other side does this. They try to lure Israeli soldiers in and then kill them, pretending to either or surrender or to be hostages, and then they're not.
So the very big difference between this situation and pretty much anything we've dealt with in the past and any kind of those hostage movies that we've seen is right now, there are so many hostages. We have no idea where they are. They are not being held in one central location as far as we know. So now we have not just, it's technically not just one hostage situation. It's hundreds that are spread out all over the country. And we know from hostages' testimonies that they're being held in homes with wives and children, that they're being held in tunnels, that they're being held in hospitals. And so each operation is almost an Entebbe unto itself. And so they're having to carry out hundreds of Entebbes just to try to get their people back with very little information. It's when you think of it like that, it's a shockingly complicated situation.
Exactly. And on top of all of that, even though we're in a position to be permanently embedded there, it's not like we could fly into Entebbe had we gone into Germany, we're just a small force. We have a massive military force there. Right. But on top of that, Ellie, Israel has stupidly set the standard of bargaining where it's so lopsided. You know, I've been saying for years, Israel should have demanded the Human Rights Council pass a resolution condemning, you know, Arab terrorists for setting a standard whereby they believe that, what, 1,000, one Jew is worth 1,000 Arabs?
Right.
Who's devaluing the price of the Palestinians are the Arabs. You're saying one Jew is worth 1,000. We understand that. We're saying that we value life so highly. We'll pay almost anything to get one Jew back, even a Jewish mm-hmm. body back, of a dead soldier. But the reality is what's holding up is a lot of negotiations going on now. There's a full court press on Israel to reach some sort of ceasefire in some hostage situation. And what all the news is saying, I'm not privy to the discussions, but what all the news is saying is basically Hamas, which you think about it, is hiding like a bunch of rats in sewers. And the only card they have is international pressure against Israel, using their own civilians as a screen, and also holding hostages, is demanding pretty much that all, like every single security prisoner, because we got a lot of people now. Think about it. For Shalit, they released over 1,000 prisoners. We got over, 100 plus. That should be worth, we should get 10,000 prisoners, including Israel used to always make a distinction. Once you've already crossed that red line and start releasing disproportionate numbers of people, okay, we'll release a lot of people, but no one with blood in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like people who attempted to kill Jews or only wounded Jews, but an active terrorist who killed a Jew. That distinction to me is irrelevant.
Right.
It might make us feel better, but these are all people who want us dead.
Like you can have the attempted murderers, but not the murderers.
Right.
And
Sinwar is a classic example. Not only was he released in that hostage exchange, but the guy had a brain tumor and Israel operated on the guy.
Right.
Are we kidding? Only Jews do this stuff. This is a crazy situation. He is the mastermind behind what happened on October 7th. There's a great halachic point. There's an interesting discussion. If you're merciful to the wicked, you end up being wicked to the merciful.
Yeah.
If you show misplaced mercy to people who deserve to be punished, you let the cycle killer go free because his mother was a crackhead and he was raised in the most abusive situation in the world. Nebuch, the poor guy, but you let him go. He'll go and kill 20 more innocent people. And we already know that because of this releasing this disproportionate exchange, it should always have been one for one. And because these people go back to being, they don't like, and they make them sign a document, they won't do terrorism anymore. They literally, with the Shalit exchange, we have to promise. They're all like this. I promise, their fingers all crossed but behind their back.
Well, again, then we're also running into a really different value system where they understand us more than we understand them, because there is a piece of the rules of war in radical Islam is you can lie in order to further your position. Like that is actually a tool of war, is telling lies. So, which is different than a Jewish worldview, which is we're going to do our best not to do that. Like it's in the Ten Commandments. So it's a really a severe underestimation of the lengths that our enemy will go to in order to be able to win this situation and twist the truth and take advantage of people who feel that life is important.
Exactly. That's why I hate when they try and show like some sort of, make some equal thing between Israel and Hamas. There's no comparison to how Israel behaves in war and Israeli soldiers and minimizing casualties, and Hamas deliberately using their population and targeting our civilians. It's a completely different reality. They hope to have as many civilians killed as possible precisely because it gets them more sympathy and they're willing to sacrifice anything for that. So they're taking advantage of our weakness, which is why, again, halakha steps in. We have so many examples of this. You can't be more merciful than God. All human beings are made in the image of God. But we have laws about when you spare life, when you take life. We taught the world value of life, but we also taught the world that there are situations in which you can kill another human being for self-defense. There's a death penalty in Jewish law. The situations you have to go to war to destroy evil. And right. You can't just take principles out of their halakhic context and try and apply them, because then you end up releasing people who hate you. And there have been many, many, many Israelis and Jews who've been killed by people who Israel had taken, had captured, had released, and then went back to doing what they did again. And Sinwar is arguably right. The worst example of that. So we're stuck between
it's interesting because it is very much about this idea today, which is a big parlance in the psychological community, like healthy boundaries, right? And in a way we're seen as this big army, but we struggle with having healthy boundaries with our enemies in terms of saying you can't do this, and we're going to do everything we can to stop you from doing this. And because we hold often so tight to certain lines, we are, our hands are tied sometimes, because we won't cross certain moral and ethical lines in order to get our people back. So it's a really interesting, when you look at it, that we sometimes need healthier boundaries to be able to say no. This is unacceptable.
But our it's interesting. This is a Jewish collective personality. The Torah says Jews are Rachmanim Baishanim V'gomli Chasidim. In general, we say Jews are merciful people, and they're merciful, modest, and like to do kindness. It's not in the Jewish personality to like to rape, pillage, and slaughter. There are whole civilizations that lived on this stuff. I mean, the Romans, for all of their fantastic culture, boy, did they like destruction and conquest. Boy, did the Huns. Boy, did the Mongols. You go back to the Bible, when God says, wipe these people out, they're your arch enemies, we don't do it.
Right.
We're trying to second guess God. You can't be more merciful than God. We have to
There's so many stories of that in our own text, our own Torah, of where we're told, wipe out this entire people, and we don't do it. And it ends up biting us. It comes back to bite us.
But it's to our credit that we don't do that, because we're just not cruel people. Eric Hoffer is a social thinker from the mid-20th century. He said Jews are the only people in the world who are expected to actually act like Christians. So we got to turn the other cheek. But the only thing that makes that worse, Ellie, is the fact that not only do we not do this, but what we're accused of is so much harsher than how anyone else behaves. Like, no army, there's no debating this. And you see that this conflict, despite the massive damage to what's happening and the civilian casualties, which are not worse than in urban warfare, there's always a massive amount of civilian casualties. Israel is actually minimizing those casualties. But on top of everything we have to deal with, in our own, to our credit, reluctance to be cruel and do all the stuff that other people would have done had their people been taken hostage, the world is dumping on Israel as if Israel are like the Huns or the Mongols or the Nazis.
Right.
And it's the inverse. Like, they're projecting onto us what they would do.
Yes.
When we are, it's just not the way the Israeli army behaves. You have this idea of purity of arms, which is one of the doctrine of the IDF. The cruelty is never allowed. You see, it's just such not in the Jewish personality, even if it means, and the problem is we're being nice to people who hate us back. It's not that they're going to suddenly turn around and go, oh, these Jews are so nice. Wish they were governing us rather than us.
Yeah.
But we're stuck between a rock and a hard place, between our soft-heartedness, our mercifulness, and Jews are not vengeful people. And the world accusing us of the worst, genocide. Like, we suck at genocide. I mean, the Arab population, Palestinians, their population keeps growing. We don't manage. We drop, missiles that are worth tens of thousands of dollars, and we hit an empty building. That's not really good at genocide. We wanted to finish off. We could carpet bomb Rafah. God forbid we could do such a thing. And we could kill literally hundreds of thousands of Palestinians within a few hours, if Israel wanted to do such a thing.
Yeah, and this has been part of the lost narrative, honestly. If we just wanted to kill everyone in Gaza, this war would have been over in 3 days. Done. Right. Finished. But we would have bulldozed them into the sea, and that would have been the end of Gaza, period.
But if the world would have said the correct, honest thing, that first of all, Israel is fighting a war for survival and its defense, and the people who started this war are Hamas, and the people who are violating international law and guilty of war crimes, not only against Israelis, but against their own population, using them as human shields, are them. And are they're responsible for all casualties, and Israel's behaving with more. If the world would just line up in back of Israel in what is the most justified, clear, unambiguous struggle against evil, and call evil evil and good good, and it doesn't mean you can't care about Palestinian civilians, this war would end very fast, because what the bad side is counting on is Europe equivocating, liberal democracies, you know, feeling, you know, with a lot of their warped ideology, and who's ever bigger, stronger is always wronger, gonna eventually put enough pressure on us to keep us from accomplishing what we need to do and what is a very moral, justified, and correct war that Israel is fighting on a standard that no army in the modern world, in the most difficult conditions of urban warfare, with massive civilian population trapped, it's the most difficult war I could think of anyone fighting in modern human history, and we have nothing to be embarrassed about.
And I think keeping the hostages front and center as a symbol of the illegality and criminality of Hamas is really, really important, because it's the story that keeps trying to be buried in the pro-Palestinian movement in North America. You know, there was actually a great clip the other day of, first of all, there's been all kinds of lies being spread now throughout the pro-Palestinian community that there are no hostages or people weren't killed. It's all just bananas and demented. But there was a great clip the other day of Eric Adams in New York City, where people were yelling at him, like, why aren't you calling for a ceasefire? And da da da. And he just walked up to them and said, bring the hostages home and then we can talk. And that was it. Like, he just shut them up, because how can you, if you really see that holding hostages is criminal, illegal, immoral, unethical, then there's just, you know, there's just nothing to say at this point. So
exactly.
Is there any, okay, so based on our history, and as we've said, now we understand that bringing all these hostages home is almost like trying to do 100 different versions of Entebbe. Any light at the end of the tunnel? Sorry for the, that's a terrible way to say it, but based on what's possibly happening, but what are some of the options and where should we go from here in terms of what's possible with the hostages? Do we know anything else at this point?
Well, yeah, I mean, what Israel is doing is basically the correct thing. Number one is you have to keep the pressure on your enemies, because one of the things they're trying to gain is not just release of prisoners, but they're using them for the ceasefire. So you have to let them know that Israel is not equivocating. Bibi has been very clear on this. No matter what, Hamas is finished. So whatever we're willing to negotiate for you, be it a ceasefire or be it a release of some prisoners, in the end, is not going to be a permanent ceasefire. Israel cannot give in on that point. So it has to be, you know, pressing its war to A, defeat Hamas, and B, try and locate the hostages. You know, I don't know what's going to be. I'm sure that we don't know how many of them are still alive. More and more it's coming out that these people are presumed dead or they're found dead. Even if we trap, you know, Hamas into a small area, like Sinwar is in some room, he's probably surrounded by a lot of these people. And the difficulty of, you know, extricating hostages from a situation where they could, you know, it could be the last thing that Hamas people try and do is, if we're going to go, we're going to take you with us.
Right.
Kind of thing. Yeah. So to continue to negotiate within reason for Israel is like, for every one you release, we'll give you like three, right, which is, I think, overpriced, but a lot better than 1,000 for one.
Yeah.
But Israel can't back down off of that either, because that's viewed as a tremendous victory.
Right.
So it's almost, if without the hostages being involved in this, Israel would have even less leverage in terms of the eyes of the international community.
Right. Yeah.
Then it would be just like, you know, okay, enough. You smashed them into the ground, and okay, they started it, but you finished it. You killed 10 times more of them than they killed of you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it gives Israel, as you said correctly, it gives Israel sort of the moral, we have the moral high ground without that, but it continues to be a big issue on the fact that some of the world is so warped that they walk around tearing down posters of hostages in places like New York, or taking the same image, putting up a 2-year-old and writing occupier.
Right.
As if these people are guilty, because all Israelis are guilty of the occupation, because Israel in its inception is illegitimate and aware that where these people live, even if they're not settlers, which is the most evil of the evil in their eyes, these people are all. So you could see the inability the ability of lies and falsehood to kind of permeate the thinking or lack thereof of so many people in the Western world is the scary part of all of this. That's the really scary in many ways.
And the desire to eliminate or erase the hostage, the hostages being hostages, because that represents the one of the symbols of the moral high ground of what Israel is doing, which is why the pro-Palestinian movement keeps trying to bury that lead. Because the more we talk about hostages, the less you can see the Palestinians as victims that are innocent. Because if anybody that holds hostages is criminal.
Exactly. And yet people walking around now, and even have useful idiots on the left, I see, people don't even know where Gaza is or where Israel is or what river to what sea they're talking about.
Yeah.
Talking about by any means, like anything that they, okay, there was rapes that probably exaggerated or made up by the Zionists, but whatever, because Israel is the evil occupier, we have anything within our arsenal that we can do to end the occupation.
Right.
The legitimate existence of a Jewish state is, that just shows you how warped the situation has become. You know, the only good thing is when the hostages are released, besides it's releasing hostages, is the news cycle switches over for a day or two, and that becomes the lead story, and suddenly it's back on the front page that Israel's able to release some hostages.
Yeah.
But like I said, those people who may be in the middle aren't decided one way or another are impacted by that. And those people who are just bought into the narrative and the lies, I don't think they're going to be swayed by that. But this is really a battle. Ultimately, like everything we're fighting, it's a battle for truth and reality.
Yep.
And we're just at the epicenter of it. And it's very, very unambiguous who's right, who's wrong in the struggle. But because of the nature of the lack of clarity in the world today and woke ideology, and like I said, who's ever bigger, stronger is always wronger, and there's only two classes of people, the strong and the weak, the victims and the victimizers, you know, no matter how you try and explain the situation, Israel, in the eyes of certain people, is always going to end up being the aggressor and the victimizer, and therefore always in the wrong.
Yeah.
So that is really the scariest issue of all of this, ultimately, you know.
Yeah.
Personal issue of our threats to Israel aside, and we wanting our soldiers and hostages to be freed, that's the issue that scares me about what it reveals about where a large percentage of the world is holding.
Correct.
Is the inability to call good good, evil evil, and be into truth, not narrative.
Yeah, and we just saw that recently in Toronto, right, where Mount Sinai Hospital was under siege by a pro-Palestinian riot. So yeah, it's the pressure is increasing. But I do think that I think it would be strategically and morally right to focus much more clearly on the hostages and that situation in North America, because I think it will wake people up, because we're trying to fight anti-Semitism and get the hostages back and win the war, and sometimes that gets really confusing for people. If we just choose to advocate for bringing the hostages and for Hamas to release them, it might be able to unify us and create a message that everyone can get behind in a very clear way.
Absolutely. And then it takes
amazing.
Someone, it takes a small percentage of Jews. The hostages are victims. Oh my God. It changes the narrative 100%. It has to be kept forefront. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so, so much. Please, I think there's so much more that we could talk about with this, but we're going to try to get a couple more episodes to you listeners in the next week or so. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, please like, share, subscribe, let people know about the podcast if you think this would be interesting. The last bunch of episodes are all really relevant to what's going on in Israel right now. I want to mention again, Rabbi Ken Spiro is going to be touring. So he'll be in North America in March. If you're in a city that he's going to, definitely go see him speak. If you want more information, you can check him out on his website. And I think that's it for now. Thanks so much, Rabbi Ken Spiro, for joining us from Jerusalem.
Thank you, Ellie. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.